It's August 13th, 2012, and I am interviewing a gentleman who I will have introduce himself, who worked for Lake Shippers Clearance Association. So we'll start with an easy question. Your name?
My name's Dan O'Connor.
And we'd like to start, we have sort of a standard set of questions, like changes and challenges and your work life and so on. I find that when I ask people to start talking about their work life, they end up dealing with a lot of those questions without us having to talk specifically about them.
Right.
But I also like to start with how your earliest connection with the grain trade. So I understand your father had some involvement in the grain trade. So if you just tell us a bit about his story.
Yes.
And his name?
My father was Mark O'Connor, and he and about four or five other farmers out in Saskatchewan got together and came here during the war to help the elevators who were short of men. And the idea was that they would work at the elevators until freeze-up, and Saskatchewan Pool, the elevators that they were working at, would send them, pay their way back home, and would also pay their way here if they agreed to come. So my father, along with these others, came here and worked in the elevators. He came, I believe it was in 1943, and once he got established a bit and was able to find a suitable home for the family, he made a down payment on a small little home out in what was Stanley Park, right near the airport. And about a year after he was here, he brought the rest of the family, my mother, myself, my brother, and two sisters, and we moved into Stanley Park and spent the rest of their lives there.
Now, you'd mentioned they'd come with a group of people. What were some of the names of the other people who came along with them? And whereabouts in Saskatchewan did they come from?
Well, some of them came from Gull Lake, some came from Swift Current, some came from Shaunavon. And I think there were, well, the ones that I know, the bunch that my father was with, worked eventually at Saskatchewan Pool 5, which at that time was Western Grain Terminal, in the Cam River, just downriver from Patterson's and the swing bridge. And some of the people that were with him were a fellow by the name of Roy Lytle, who eventually became a foreman at Pool 5. There were some Schomperlin brothers, Ben and Jean, and I think there were three or four more too, but which I the names just escaped me at the moment. But they all came and they all stayed, and once the term was up, when the freeze up came, they were all offered employment with Saskatchewan Pool, and they stayed and made a life here in Thunder Bay. Most of them lived in the West Ford area. My father was living out closer to the airport.
They came here during the war. When the war ended then, were their jobs impacted at all? Because my father was in that group that came back from the war and went to work in the elevators.
I think there was a lot of work for these people who were coming back. I think at that time everybody was short of work, and I know the five or six that I'm talking about all were able to hold their jobs, even though the fellows coming back, some of them went back to the elevator as well.
What did your dad do at the elevators?
He was on the distributing floor. He was responsible for distributing the grain to different bins in the elevator.
So as a kid, did you visit the elevator?
Not very much. I did visit the elevator just to see what it was like and what he was doing and so on. But I never spent much time around the elevator. I was more fascinated with the ships and what was going on in the river with the tugs and so on. And the elevators were just, I knew they were a very integral part of the operation, but at the same time, they didn't have the same appeal to me as the ships had.
Mm-hmm. How long did your dad end up working for the elevator?
Well, my dad worked from 1940, probably late 1943, and he worked right up until he retired, and that would have been in 1976, and unfortunately he passed away 2 years after that. Mm.
Do you know who owned the Western Elevator at the time that he was working with them?
It was a company called Western Grain, I think, that owned what was Saskatchewan Pool 5. And I don't know just when Saskatchewan Pool took it over, but they were certainly operating it shortly after my father started working there. My dad had sent us pictures of where, had marked in the elevator where he was working on this picture. And so, you know, we had no idea what a grain elevator was, but he sent this picture, and it was Western Grain right up until Saskatchewan Pool took it over. I'm not too sure what year it was.
Mm-hmm. So how did your own career in industry get started?
Well, it's quite a funny way that I got into the... Actually, I finished working. I started working, I should say, on June 23rd, 52. I was out of high school, right out of high school, and I had been looking for work and for the summer holidays. And a friend of mine and I would go down to the employment office and try and get some employment for a month or two. And I bumped into him one Friday and asked him how he was making out. And he said, "Well, I got a job, but I don't really want this job." He said, "I've joined the Air Force." And I said, "Well, where is this?" So he told me it's at a place called Lake Shippers, up in the Grain Exchange building, which was Chapels. So I said, "Well," his name was Bob Walker, I said, "Well, Bob, if you don't want the job, maybe I'll go there and they'll hire me for 2 months." So I went there and I met Mr. Marshall, who was the office manager at the time, and he said, "Oh, come right in, Mr. Walker." So I went into the office and he checked me out and said, "Can you add?" And no, "Oh yeah, sure, I can do this." So he gave me the job for 2 months. And just about the time the 2 months was over, the manager at the time came to me and said that if I wanted a full-time job, I could have it. So I thought about it for quite a while, and then I decided, yes, I really enjoyed the busy office. I enjoyed what was going on. I enjoyed the people there, and I thought, well, I can do this. I'll spend the rest of my life here. And as it turned out, I spent three quarters of my life. I started when I was 15, and I worked until I was 60. Three quarters of my life at that time.
So from 1952 to
96. June 23rd, 52 to the end of August 1996.
Hmm. So we had a member of the Chapel family come in to the display the other day, and I said, "You really should join our people wall, because the Chapel's building was, you know, where the Grain Commission first was,
right.
The Grain Exchange,
yes.
And Lake Shippers." What was it like in that building when you started? Who else, what other organizations were there?
Well, when I started, the Chapels were still there, of course.
On the ground floor,
on the ground floor,
right.
Retail. But up there were lawyers on the third or fourth floor, And on the fifth floor where our office was where most of the grain people were. The grain trimmers were there. There was a railway office. I think the CNR had a little office there. Hellet and Carey, which was a grain firm, had an office there. And we had almost the top floor. We had the top floor on, and it went on the east side and the north side. Because we had so many employees, we had about two-thirds of the top floor.
Mm. Where the Grain Commission was in that building too at the time?
They were in that building too on the, I believe they were on the fourth floor.
Okay.
Yeah, either third or fourth floor.
So a lot of things happening in those days.
A lot of things happening in those days.
Mm. And what about the office itself? Can you describe what it was like?
Well,
and what it was like when you started, like what you thought when you finally...
Okay, when I started there, we had, first of all, in the north end of that top floor of Chapel Building, we had a sort of like a separate office, which was for all of the girls. And there were at that time about 9 girls doing nothing but typing all day long. Then we had, along with that, we had the main office. And we had people looking after the rail shipments, people looking after the vessel shipments, and people dealing with the elevators, getting all this different information that we needed. And then we had the boss had a private office on the corner of Victoria and Syndicate.
And who was the boss at that time?
At that time, the boss was Robert Davidson Milligan. He was the boss. And Jack Hindle was right under him. And then there was Bill Sinclair and several other fellows who had been there for a long, long time when I started. And I really got along well with all of the staff up there, these older fellows. I got a real charge out of it. they did their job, but they liked the kibitz a little bit too, and it was a wonderful atmosphere. Very, very nice.
Now, I mentioned to you that we did interview a couple of people from the Winnipeg operation, so they were able to say from their end what they did. Maybe it would be great for us to have on tape just exactly what Lake Shippers did, because
right.
We know that we're experiencing that they are no longer existing by the end of this month. And I imagine it changed over time, because certainly the size of the office did.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the gentlemen that were dealing with the different compartments mm-hmm. of the operation. So maybe just go through...
Okay, well, the reason Lake Shippers was formed was because in the early days of shipping grain out of Thunder Bay, ships would come into the port and would have to go to maybe half a dozen elevators to pick up their cargoes. And the reason for that was that even up until I retired, Every bit of grain that comes into the port, when it's dumped, it's weighed and graded and so on, and there's a receipt issued for that grain. That's called a warehouse receipt. That warehouse receipt is turned over to the Lake Shippers, and we, in fact, own that grain until the grain is loaded. And we arrange the payment on... everything to do with the loading of loading, unloading, and everything to do with the ships. In other words, if a car of grain comes in here and is dumped, we pay the cleaning on the elevators for cleaning. We pay them for storing the grain. We pay them for weighing the grain, loading the grain. We don't pay the grain trimmers, although we inform the grain trimmers where their ships are going to go so that they can have adequate crews, to make the loading that much easier. But, so, like I'm saying, we would hold these warehouse receipts, And then once the shipment was completed, we would make out the bills of lading and turn them over. We looked after all the grain going out by rail in the same fashion. We'd make up bills of lading. And back in the early days, you had a bill of lading for every car of grain, even though we were shipping 100 car loads down to Montreal and places like that for the wheat board. And there was a separate certificate for every car. And what we did in later years was work closely with the government weighing department and the government inspection department to combine all those certificates into one to take care of that one train load. And we did much the same with the ships. And so my job was, as far as the ships are concerned, my job was to find out when the ships were going to come into the port, see what grain had been ordered for them, had been bought. And since we held the warehouse receipts, we could, if there was enough grain of one kind, send the ship into one elevator to get a load and get, you know, he'd get out of the port as quickly as he possibly could. So, it was the same with the rail cars coming in. We wanted to make sure, another very important part of the job was to make sure that every elevator had enough space in the elevator to keep these cars get the cars dumped and back out to the prairies. That was another very important part. I don't know whether I'm missing something here that something else that I should be saying, but we also had to keep the government weighing department and inspection department informed as to where the ships were going to be. I had to contact the ships and tell them what elevators to go to. I had to work out a stowage plan to decide where the grain was going to go that was ordered for the ship, what holds it was going to go into, and give the order to the elevator, asking them to load. We would, you know, fax this order over to them, phone it to them, and so on, and tell them what we wanted them to load. And we knew what grain was in the elevators because they would be reporting figures to us every day of grain that was available for shipping, not necessarily grain that was in the elevator because some of it wasn't ready to ship yet. But once we got a list every morning, we had people phoning the elevators, they were reporting to us what grain they had available for shipping. And we didn't care who owned the grain. We knew, but we didn't care. It didn't matter to us. We could, if we had grain and the ship could get a two-house load, we would go to two houses. And we were paid in Thunder Bay for the service that we provided for the ship owners in getting their vessels turned around quickly. Before we were formed, they were in port sometimes for a week, better than a week a lot of times, going and picking up small parcels that were ordered from this elevator, something a little bit from the next elevator, and so on. So with us being in there and being in control of all that, we worked along the line of a bank clearinghouse. Once the ships were finished loading, then we sorted the paper out and paid everybody. And our Winnipeg office operated on a charge that we made to the shippers because we were also doing them a big service by getting the grain down quicker. And everybody, we were a non-profit organization, and everybody was quite happy with the way things were going.
Now, you were run by a board, I understand.
We had a board of directors that was elected each year from the members of Lake Shippers.
And how did you become a member of
Lake
Shippers?
Well, no one could ship grain out of the port unless they were a member of the Lake Shippers, because we held all these warehouse receipts. So nobody could ship grain out of the port unless they were a member of the Lake Shippers. So consequently, almost every shipper was a member of the Lake Shippers, and some of the vessel owners were also members of the Lake Shippers.
And why would the vessel owners?
Well, because they saw that things were working out pretty well, And at the end of the year, being non-profit, whatever profit we had was turned back to the shippers. And originally, it was felt that we would lose money every year, and we would be subsidized by the members. And that only happened twice. Once it happened, while I was manager or general manager, and we were about three ships short of breaking even for the year, and we had a bad freeze up. Ships couldn't get through, and then they eventually closed the Sioux locks. They warned the vessel owners that the ships couldn't get through for the last three or four, and it was a small loss that we incurred. And another time, somebody, it was long before I ever got into management, somebody was kiting the bills of lading, you know, upping them, and when it came time to ship the grain, it wasn't available, and I don't know who took the loss, but that's the only two times. And every other year we would turn back a substantial amount of money to on the basis of what they had shipped through the port. They would get a check.
Prorated.
Prorated on the basis of what they had shipped out of the port.
Now, did you have to be careful then that you were fair to all the elevators?
Definitely.
And how did you ensure that?
Well, every elevator was entitled to a certain percentage of shipping depending on what their company originated in the PERS and sent down to Thunder Bay. And we got this figure, we got these figures every week. I think we got figures from the Lakehead Terminal Elevator Association showing what these elevators are entitled to, what they actually got on the basis of the figures that we had reported to them, and we could see where we were at. And we tried, if nothing else, we tried to be as fair to every single elevator company and every single vessel. If there was ever any argument, we wanted to know about it, and we could explain it.
Because there might be one captain saying, you send me to six elevators, but Frank only gets sent to two every time he comes in.
Right. And, you know, that happened. I know of a specific case where that happened, and it was with one of Bruce Hale's ships. And he was president of the board at the time. And it was an Upper Lake shipping vessel, two vessels. One of them was the Seaway Queen. I can't remember what the other one was. And the captain of this other ship phoned up and said, well, they've got a full load for me right here at this elevator. I shouldn't have to move. And I said, I know, but, you know, that isn't the problem. We're trying to get not just you out. We're trying to help everybody. So he went to his vessel, to his owners, and told them. And they phoned me back, and it was Captain Jim Hartford. I'd been with them for years, and I knew him well. And he said, I got a call. He said, I'm just wondering, what's the real story? So I told him, I said, well, we could get him out. We could get him, you know, he'll be finished by 9 o'clock tonight if we leave him there. But if we shift him, he might get out to 10 o'clock, but he'll still get out. And on top of it, because he's vacating that berth, this other ship of yours is going to get in there, and he'll also get out. He said, that's all I want to know. And that was the end of that. Yeah. And it only happened once in the 44 years that I was there. I wasn't in charge for 44 years, but you know, the last while when I was in charge, it only happened one time. And we wanted to hear about that sort of stuff so that we could prove that no. And at the end of the year, we would have to, you know, show exactly what we did. Everything was out there for everybody to see. And we put out a vessel report every single day, which showed the, I think you had a copy of it. It showed the ships that were loading in port, the ships that were due, and what the ships took and where they took it and all this sort of stuff. So it was quite an operation, and we were very, very busy. I know that they talked about, I was looking back in some of the records here, and I know they talked about shipping, I think it was in 2011, about shipping over 800,000 tons in 1 month. And that, you know, that, and that's quite a feat. But in 1986, in 1 weekend, it was a weekend after the elevators had been on strike, and they came back to work on Friday and worked Friday, Saturday. We had, the ships were in the bay waiting, and the elevators were gung-ho to go, you know, 12 hours a day if they had to or more. We loaded 700,000 tons on 32 ships just in that 1 weekend. And in 1983, the big year, I know I was working day and night, but in 1983, we loaded 17,700,000 tons in 885 ships. And when you figure, you can just imagine, you know, the coordination that was needed for that. it was hair-raising, I'm telling you. But we got through it, and I had tremendous help from an awful lot of people, like Roy Ward. In later years, Roy Ward was a tremendous help to me. And there were other fellows in the office, like in the later years, like Gino Terriol, who knew the business inside out. And Nick Hardy knew the rail end of it pretty good. And there was a number of them, but they were all very, very good employees. We also had a number of girls who were excellent employees. If you had something that had to be done, and in those days we worked from 9 till 5 with an hour and a half off for lunch, and if we had some work that had to be done after 5 o'clock, they always did it. Never, ever complained. They were, it was an exceptional crew to work with.
So if we, you gave an explanation of the different things that that were involved in the whole process, I had a little difficulty with sort of putting it in order. So if we start the a grain shipment, mm-hmm. coming from the west,
right?
Where did Lake Shippers start to fit into the situation? And then you've already explained quite nicely
fit into the situation. We had nothing to do with the grain coming into the port. But once it got to the port and was dumped, inspected and weighed, that's when we took over, you know. And then our responsibility to the elevators, of course, ended when that's grain left the elevator spout. We still had an obligation to the vessel owners and the shippers, which ended once the grain was unloaded and all the accounts were settled and everything.
So you would have to follow it right to the customer.
Exactly. Not necessarily to the customer, but to the unloading elevator.
Okay, so yeah. Wherever, like down in the St. Lawrence or whatever.
Yeah, right. If it went to Montreal or Quebec City or, you know, wherever it went.
Yeah. So the positions then that existed, we had the clerk typists. Mm-hmm. I know from looking at some of your records that there was a receptionist.
Right.
And then the sort of more administrative issues, you referred sort of to them but not directly. So the lady I was interviewing earlier today, Carmen Smiley is her married name. She was one of the clerk typists. And she referred to this the sort of back room that you were talking about, where the clerk typists were. And she said, and the managers were at the front. So who were the desks at the front? What were those positions? And which position did you take when you first started?
When I first started, I started as a bookkeeper. They called them ledger keepers. And what I was doing was keeping track of the grain as it came into the elevators and was turned over to us. We had to make entries into books to keep a record of what every elevator had of every grade. And originally, the grades like for wheat, for example, it was called northern, like one northern, two northern, three northern, four northern, five wheat, six wheat, and feed wheat. Now you've got protein levels. So there's all these different grades. It's Canada, like one CW, one Canada Western Red Spring, 12.5, 13.5. We're the only country in the world, as far as I know, I think we're still the only country in the world that can guarantee the protein level, which is very, very important to bakers for one. They have to know that they're going to get a loaf of bread that's so long and so high, it's going to fit into those little cellophane packages that they have. And if it doesn't, there's trouble. If you get a poorer grade of grain that hasn't got, you don't know what the protein level is, you're going to have big air bubbles in it and stuff like that. So when we came along figuring that it was the government switching over to these protein levels, would give them a real in when it came to selling grain, export grain, particularly. So that made a big change. Mm-hmm. So I was in charge there were three or four of us mm-hmm. doing that job. Each of us had so many elevators, and back in those days there were, 24 elevators or something when I started. And so we each had so many elevators that we had to keep track of grain coming in, and every time there was a shipment we'd have to subtract it from that, so we knew up to the minute what was in there.
A running total of several
different grades: wheat, oats, barley, flax.
That must have been quite the ledger.
Oh yes, it was quite a job.
So each page had each elevator had its own page or its own book?
Well, each elevator, we had one great big book for maybe four elevators. And there were four of us at one time doing that job. And when I started, and we started on a high desk that sloped, and we were sitting on stools and keeping track of that. And then I did that for I don't know how many years, and then they promoted me to telecommunications, and I worked on the teletype and telex for 10 or 12 years.
So what did that involve?
That involved sending messages between the two offices so that our Winnipeg office knew what was going on too. Even though we were doing the loading, we wanted them to be able to answer any questions that the shippers had, or even the vessel brokers in Winnipeg could go to them and get information. And we kept sending messages up to them, telling them first thing in the morning we'd give them a lineup where the ships are, and then we'd tell them this one's going to get out, this one won't, this one will get out tomorrow, and all the way through. We'd review that and maybe update it at noon, and the next day we'd have another one. And every bit of grain that was loaded, there was a form made out by somebody in the office in a different department that contained all this information. I had to wire all that stuff up to Winnipeg too. So I would, in a day, I might send, it was nothing to send 100 messages a day, up to.
And you were sending messages by?
Started off with a teletype.
Now, what was that?
That was,
it
was like an electric typewriter, really. Yeah. And then then they came out with telex, or telex first, I guess, which was like an electric typewriter that went, and they had the same machine in Winnipeg, and everything that I was putting in there was coming out on the machine in Winnipeg, and we were sending messages back and forth. And then from there, I went to another position. It was the assistant loading desk. And the loading desk was where the big decisions were made as to where the ship, like the manager, general manager, whoever it was, would decide what was going to happen. And that was all done right there. And the assistant would be the one that would actually make out the order. Somebody else would phone it to the elevator. And then when the elevator loaded the ship, they would call the information back into us. and then we would wire it up to Winnipeg so they knew what was going on. And then from there, I was promoted to onto the loading desk, and a short time later, I was the assistant manager, and then the manager, and then manager of Thunder Bay, and general manager, and then I, you know, got to be the head of the whole association.
Still out of Thunder Bay?
Still out of Thunder Bay, yeah. Yeah. Even though our board of directors were in Winnipeg, and they considered that the head office, I was responsible for Winnipeg as well. Mm. But we had good people there, like Beverly has got, you know, wealth of knowledge. She's been in the business a long time, too. Yeah.
So did everything always go smoothly between here and Winnipeg? Because it seems sort of, from an outsider anyway, a bit of a chance of duplication of effort? Was that ever an issue?
No. We never had any problem at all with Winnipeg. They were doing what they were doing. We were, in some respects, there was a little bit of duplication, but they were dealing more with the shippers, whereas we were dealing more with the vessel owners. We had work to do for the shippers and the railways as well, because I was also agent for the railways.
So what was that, agent for the railways?
Well, we would have to order out, again, we would have the list of available grain, and if the wheat board, for example, was short of grain in Montreal in the wintertime, we would have to send 100 car unit trains down and get the grain down there in a hurry, because there were ocean ships waiting to take it. So we'd have to make bills of lading for every, like I was saying before, for every bit of grain that was loaded. We had to make out the bills, and then they had to be signed. And it's just, so we acted as the agent for the railways, and they would come up and pick up the bills of lading and in our office. Whereas with the ships, I was the agent, and I signed. My signature was on the bottom of every bill. Before we computerized, we had to get somebody to sign their name on every piece of paper, and there were a lot of papers. So these girls in the back, if they weren't busy typing, the ones I had authorized to sign on my behalf were signing bills. So we had one girl, her name was Mary Was, W-O-S, such a short name, M Was. So she used to get the big, thick files and sign her name. So, and she could do that in no time. But the other girls with longer names, they were doing a lot more typing. Yeah.
So did everything, well, maybe we talk about, I know we talked about this on the telephone, nothing to do with you. I don't think you went out and stood near the Empire Elevator with the signaling flags. But tell me about that. There was a person that was hired who went out. Their job was at the signaling shack. So tell us a little bit about what you
That was at the Empire Elevator, and they had the flags, and they could spell out to the ships where they wanted them to go with these flags. And they chose that because it was sort of a point. At that time, there were elevators up, quite a few elevators up the Cam River. So first of all, they wanted to go up the Cam River, and then when they got closer, they could tell them exactly which elevator. And the same as the Mission in the North End. And they would signal to them with these flags. And that guy must have been very busy, whoever it was. That was quite a while before my time.
And how did you communicate with ships after the flags were no longer?
And then after that, I used to talk to them. They'd phone when they get to the Sioux. Usually, what they would do is send me a telegram saying that they were at the Sioux, and we knew they were coming, but we just didn't know when they're going to get there. So when they got to the Sioux, they'd send us a message and let us know they arrived at the Sioux at such and such a time. And I knew from that information when they would be here. And so, like, in other words, if a ship got through the Sioux at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he would be here for 8 o'clock the next morning. He'd just make it. They about 16 hours to get from the Sioux to Thunder Bay, most of them. Some of them were a little slower, but we knew what they were. And so we would send them, if we couldn't contact them on our radio phone, I had a ship-to-shore radio right on my desk. If I couldn't contact them on that, we would send a message through the Coast Guard, which we are not going to have anymore. But anyway, I would send a message through the Coast Guard, and they would contact the ship through the night whenever they could to make sure that he got the information that I had on the message for him. And then after that, I think Roy now, at the last little while, was doing it all by probably teletype or computer or probably on the cell phones. He could, when they get close enough. But that's how I used to do it, went through the telegraph office.
So if a ship came in at midnight,
mm-hmm.
If they came, in those very busy days.
Yeah. It depended on how busy we were. Like, at certain times a year, they could staff, put extra crews on. And like, a lot of them would put on two crews if they knew that there were going to be a lot of ships around. And because if they weren't using them for loading, they still needed extra men to, you know, at night maybe to unload cars. So they'd want to know from us what are the prospects. So we'd have a weekly meeting, you know, with the railways, the lake shippers, the grain transportation agency. We'd have this meeting once a week. I think it was on Thursdays, and it lasted for an hour or so. And they wanted to know really what does it look like for next week. Of course, we had all the information from the vessel brokers, and we knew what was supposed to be in port, so we could give them a pretty good idea. And the railways could tell the elevators what they had in the way of cars to send. Loaded cars to send here, so with that information, they would gear up to get busy, and we kept them busy. If they weren't loading ships, they were dumping cars, and worked out pretty well.
Where were those meetings held?
They were held over usually in the Port Arthur, the old post office building in Port Arthur.
At the Grain Transportation Office.
GTA office, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we did have them in the... a few times in the post office building on right by the gardens, because we had our office in there for a while.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, just for a short while. We were there for, I don't know, maybe 7 years or something like that. But the rest, and then we went back to the chapel building. But we had them there quite a few times as well.
Now, when I visited Roy Ward today, I was looking at the safe in the hallway. Did you guys ever use that safe for anything?
In the hallway, we had a big walk-in safe that was right in our office. Partway down the hall there is another one that we had nothing to do with that one, but we did have the same thing in the office. It had a big door on the front and then another door inside, and we kept these records that I'm talking about. A lot of them we kept right in that all the time, even our books at night. With all the figures from the elevators and so on, would go into the vault, and we'd bring them out in the morning.
Pretty disastrous if fire or whatever.
Oh yes, that's for sure. We did lose Winnipeg. The people you interviewed in Winnipeg may have mentioned to you, we did lose a lot of stuff in a flood in Winnipeg years ago. But that was in maybe in the late 40s or early 50s, maybe before
the Winnipeg flood.
Yeah.
1950.
50, yeah, so it was before I started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would happen to the books as they filled up? Did you ever toss things out, or they...
We never tossed... anything out, stuff we kept there for years and years and years. And I think at the last there, they were keeping stuff for about 5 years, because you can put it all on, you can back it up and put it on these little tapes or whatever. Mm-hmm. But back in those days, we had all files that went back, I think, back to the 1900s. We actually, the company was formed in September of
2009. 1909.
Oh, 1909, yeah. Yeah, 2009, we celebrated the 100th anniversary, right? Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So.
So what, when you think back on your career, what were your major challenges in the positions that you had?
My major challenge, once I got into management, was trying to keep everybody happy and to be fair as possible to everybody. Because, you know, we were actually trying to help the elevators, we were trying to help the grain trimmers, we were trying to help the railways, we were trying to help the GTA. We were trying to help everybody, and the shippers and the owners of the and the brokers and everything. We were trying to please so many different people, and I'm not bragging, but I think we did a pretty good job. We had a real dedicated staff, and I think I don't know how things are going to run now that.
Well, it's interesting. When I first heard of late shippers, I thought I knew nothing of them. I think I probably had heard the name. But after I talked to the Winnipeg people, and, you know, they were talking about not in as much detail as you did about what they did, I said, what's going to, who's going to do that work when you're not, when you're no longer around? So, there have been changes over the years that I would think led to certainly a decrease in staff. So, if you think back to, 1952, and when you left 44 years later, mm-hmm. what changes had taken place in the operation?
Well, everything, we computerized everything.
When did that occur?
As soon as the computers came out, I can't remember what year that was, maybe in the 70s, mm-hmm. early 70s, something like that. And so as soon as that came about, we automatically, we knew we had to change. So we computerized all the bills of lading. Pretty near everything that we possibly could was computerized. And it meant, of course, that all these girls typing bills in the back office, unfortunately, we didn't need them anymore. Mm-hmm. And instead of putting a stamp on with my signature on the bottom of every piece of paper, I got the government and two or three people in the government and myself, and we worked to combine the weight and grade certificate, first of all, and we got that sorted out. Then we computerized the old bill of lading, which I think you might have a copy of. We computerized that, and everything that was on that bill of lading, and there was a date on the top of it, everything that was incorporated in that bill of lading was also incorporated, even though it wasn't on there. It was understood that all the terms and conditions and exceptions mm-hmm. Pertain to this new bill as well. And instead of having me sign it or whoever was the agent at the time, it was in the computer and was on there. So that cut a lot of the work out.
Hmm. So when you started, how many people were operating at the...
I think there was 24. Hmm. 24 in, and 24 in Thunder Bay, and there may have been 23 or something like that in Winnipeg, roughly the same number. Mm-hmm.
And when you left?
When I left, there were, I think, four in Winnipeg. And one, two, three, maybe about the same number in Thunder Bay.
Yeah. And at the same time, there was a big change in the amount of grain that was leaving here.
Right.
So did that have an impact on numbers as well, or computerization was the main?
The main thing was the computerization. You know, they talk about grain going out of Churchill hurting us too, but for the amount they shipped, we could handle that in a week or two. You know, that wasn't really a problem. What it did, really, the way it hurt us, was that it took a bunch of particularly wheat board grain, because that's all it went out of Churchill. It took a bunch of cars that would have come to Thunder Bay with wheat, and they went to Churchill, and that it was really at a time when we needed it. And maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but it was not at all economical to be shipping grain out of Churchill. And I think the only reason that port was kept open was Lloyd Axworthy. I'm sure that he was responsible for it. And you can't blame him for looking after his province.
Yeah.
But it didn't really hurt us that much. And the West Coast, well, that's another story. But what really hurt us, as much as anything, was the fact that the Russia, you know, the USSR, couldn't afford to buy grain anymore. That was the big thing. And they got to the point where they were trading tractors for grain and everything else. And finally, the Canadian Wheat Board says, "No, that's it. We got to cut them off." And that's what really hurt. Because the bulk of the grain then and in years later was wheat board grain that was going
market there. Shifted to the west coast,
right? And the Pacific Rim countries were the countries that were you know picking up the slack, and it makes sense that the grain should be going out of a Pacific Rim elevator. Mm-hmm. So it was just one of those things that over which we had no control at all.
So at one point then, almost all grain shipments were going out of Thunder Bay. And then, I think Churchill was built pretty early on, right? And West Coast elevators were built too, but not shipping much.
No.
So, but at some point, the Lake Shippers Clearance Association became Canadian Ports Clearance Association.
Right.
How did that occur and why?
That occurred, of course, after I was retired.
Okay.
And why it occurred, I have no idea. And I've talked to several people. I haven't talked to the directors, but I did talk to several other people, and I was kind of stunned to hear that they were changing the name. But I thought, well, maybe it better reflects what we're doing, because we're not just looking after, we're looking after... we were doing work for the West Coast as well.
Okay.
And so this was, maybe more, it encompassed a little more than what they thought they were doing with just Lake Shippers.
Yeah. And with the shift in the number of the tonnage, balancing out and then overbalancing towards the west, it seemed it would make a bit more sense too.
Yeah, I suppose, but...
there's not that many elevators there. It's not like coordinating 20 elevators.
No, it's Prince Rupert is the one really that was doing all the.
Mm-hmm.
It was the one that was really hurting us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any other challenges or changes then that you haven't spoken of? What about ship sizes? Does that have any impact on your?
Oh yes. Well, before the Seaway opened. We had all the small canalers, a number of small ships. We'd have 22 or 23 ships in port, on any given day. And but there were all these little small ships, and now we've got the bigger ones that load 27,000 metric tons of wheat, for example, which, is about the equivalent of 300 hopper cars, so it takes a lot of cars to keep them going.
But it would have made it easier
yeah.
from Lake Shippers' perspective because
yeah.
they didn't have to coordinate 22 ships. They might be able to do three.
Yeah, and it also made it meant that the people, because of the seaway, the rates for hauling grain reduced quite a bit, and it was something that was in the planning stage, I think, for I don't know how many years. It was probably 15 years or something before the Americans finally said, yes, we'll help out in this venture. And so they built, I don't know, there was going to be seven new locks, I think, something like that. And I believe that five of them were Canadian. So, but it allowed the ships to go from Gulf of St. Lawrence right to the lakehead, in you know, nonstop. Whereas before, the bigger ships were taking it down to Port Colborne, as for example, and dumping it, and then the other ships would come in and those ports and take it from there. Yeah. Now they could come and go. The saltwater ship could come in and load here and go right to wherever.
I have a special interest in elevators. So when you think of all the elevators that were operating, were there any idiosyncrasies of the elevators that you had to consider yourself with, sort of matching them up to ships?
There were a lot. In fact, when the ocean ships started to come here, there were only one or two elevators that could finish them, that could start them, I should say, because their spouts were high enough. Once they got down a bit, then you could, and also there were only one or two elevators that could finish them, because they loaded quite a bit deeper. Well, indeed, they were still governed by the Sioux locks, but there were a lot of different idiosyncrasies about the elevators, and one of them was like up in north, the Cam River, up by the Great Lakes.
The electric and the Northwestern.
Yeah, well, it was Lakehead.
Lakehead. That was a term I heard today, yeah. But I had never heard it called the Lakehead before.
It was Lakehead elevator, and it had one loading spout out into the over the dock, and in its corner was Northwestern. A big one, and they handled a lot of barley. And then there was the bridge, of course, the swing bridge, and Patterson's right below the bridge. And if the dam had been opened up above and the water was swift, the ships couldn't dock at Patterson's because they'd be at Pool 5 before they could get stopped. So we had to keep that in mind. But and then there was Patterson's, like I'm saying, and Pool 5, and Elevator F and E.
Now you were mentioning, and I don't think it was on tape, I think it might have been when we were talking previously about E and F.
No, Pool 5 and F.
Pool 5 and F, or Western and F.
Yeah, Western Grain and F at that time. Yeah, we could load one ship from both elevators, and we did that whenever we could. If we had some grain out of Pool 5 that had to come, we checked right away with F and see if we couldn't get them to load if the ship was headed down, to load in the forward end, and Pool 5 would load in the stern. And every once in a while, they'd have to talk to the other elevator and say, well, the ship is going to shift now, so we can get up into number 2 hold, and we'll let you know when we're going to shift again, then you can go away. So they had to give them some warning so they could get everything shut off to let the ship move. So that was another, and then there were elevators too that had the things that we knew that maybe the ships didn't know. Some of the ships didn't know, depending on whether the crew was new or not. But like over in the Mission, Cargill Elevator, for example, a ship backing out of there had to remember that there was a pile of rocks so far back, and you had to make sure to turn at the right time and all this sort of stuff. And if it was real windy, we had to keep that in mind, because if we were having a ship loading at Pool 6 and he had to load up forward, the stern. There was nothing to hold the stern of the ship on the dock. So sometimes you'd have to order a tug to hold the ship to the ship's stern over enough so that they didn't, you know, didn't get away
with
on
the, with the grain pouring into right. the lake.
Yeah. And we had one small one, small Patterson ship at one time, loading at Canada Malt. And I don't know what happened, but anyway, the ship listed badly, and it looked like it was going to go down. But they got it shut off in time, got her straightened up. But that's the only time. And one time too, a ship hit the one of the Patterson ships, not the Patterson ships. I think it was a. Might have been a CSL. CSL, I think it was that one right there. Bay St. Paul hit the lighthouse on the entrance there. Yeah.
Sort of throws your schedule off.
Oh, yeah. And some elevators, too, didn't have too much, like P&H hasn't got, when I was working there, working on the job, didn't have too much water up in the forward end, and I noticed the other day there was a great big ship in there, so I don't know whether they've dredged the slip or what, but they all had their own little idiosyncrasies, and actually the grain trimmers were, there was a head trimmer for each elevator, and he usually knew exactly what the elevator could do, and he knew whether if there was any problem with the water, where it was, and all this sort of stuff, so they were a tremendous help to the ships. And I know I've had people that I was working for tell me that we don't need these guys, you know, we can get the crews on the ship to load, and we've had to state our opinion rather rather forcefully, because they did do a very good job. And they still do, and they've been in business longer than we were, and they're mm-hmm. still going. So there's a need for them, and I hope that they're able to continue in this changing environment.
So, which elevators had sort of the nice combination of depth and spouts, and that made it pretty versatile?
Well, later on, most of them had high spouts, and most of them didn't have water problems either. But a Searle elevator over at the Mission was one that had good water, and another one was Grain Growers. Grain Growers, what was Grain Growers A at that time? The big one over in the north end, it had good water. But they all had their own loading speeds, and we knew this, so you had to take that into consideration, because you were quite often shifting boats at noon hours to when they were going for lunch to, you know, cut down on the delay to the ship. Sometimes you'd be moving into a faster elevator to get them out a little sooner than they would have if they'd stayed there, but still giving the elevator its percentage maybe on another ship the next day or something, you know.
Yeah. Quite complex when you think about
it. Oh, very, very complex. It's like somebody said, it was a big jigsaw puzzle, and it all had to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then you had to know your ships, too.
You had to know every ship. You had to know, you had to have a pretty good idea of the size of every hold of every ship. And you had to know not only that the ship is a certain, the hold is a certain size, but that you got to remember that, you know, oats would fill the hold up before you're loading it, got any amount in, whereas wheat would, you know, there'd be a lot of wheat because of the difference in the weight. And the weight and volume, it was something you had to keep your eye on all the time. And you also had to... I spent a lot of time on the stowage for the ships.
What is that?
Well, it's keeping the ship in the proper order, a proper shape to shift. In other words, you couldn't put a ship into an elevator and load the first hold with nothing in the stern at all, you know. So we'd have to try and keep the ship So they're not putting ballast in and pumping it out and putting it in, and maybe you'd have to stop and wait while they get more ballast out and this sort of thing. So we had to keep the ships on the keel the way they wanted it, pretty well all the time. And when the ship was finished, the mates would make sure that they weren't any more than, you know, whatever the draft was at the time, whether it was 27 feet or whatever it was.
Now, how would that actually be controlled? You were in an office in the Chapel's building,
right?
And this was being loaded. Mm-hmm. So did you have a load plan, a loading plan?
No, I made up the plan myself.
And
for the ship, the ship's load?
Yeah.
Yes, I made that
And then
myself.
Who did that go to?
That went to the elevators. That plan that I'm in, I didn't give them a drawing of the plan. I just told them that we'd like you to load this grain on this ship into this hold, this grain, you know, into this hold, and so on.
So first this, then this, then this, then this.
And not necessarily in order, but this is your order. And if there's a preference, we would point out, now this is a lot of grain, you might not get it all on by noon. This is what we want for sure. The other is just to keep you going, so that they knew. And we had to spot that in a place that the ship could take it without any of the sailors if it came to that.
Did ships regularly have different grains in them?
Different?
Grains.
Oh, yes. You could have...
That was usual?
Oh, yeah, they're quite common. With the wheat board shipping so much wheat, quite often you'd get wheat board shipments. You'd get maybe three or four ships a day with one grade of grain. But normally, quite often, I'll say, you would have maybe a couple of holds of barley, maybe a hold of oats. Maybe even a hold of wheat, something like that. They usually have six compartments. Some of them have five. But the majority of the bigger ones now have six compartments, but the odd one has five.
Did you have to fill a hold?
With flax. With flax, it was mandatory that we fill a hold up to a certain distance up into the hatch combing, so that the grain, flax particularly, is very, very slippery. And if you get any on the deck, they have to clean it up right away so somebody doesn't fall and hurt themselves. But with flax, and in fact on ocean ships that sometimes don't take a full hold of flax, they put in what they call shifting boards. Right down the center of the hold, they would put great big timbers from the floor level right to the between deck, or to the deck, and then they would maybe sometimes even go the other way just to keep that parcel of grain from shifting, because all that weight could play havoc with the ship if it started to ship. Shift.
So if you were loading two different products into one hold, it was normal that it was separated vertically as opposed to horizontally. There's no way of separating it.
Well, yeah, they could do it horizontally too, but they wouldn't do that because then I think then the flax would still move.
Yeah.
But what they did on some of the smaller ships that loaded, they would make a separation out of canvas, and then they came out later on with what they called a Kobe separation, which was canvas and lumber, and it was a pretty
like a system.
Yeah, a real good separation, and that was used on ocean ships quite often. They'd have little parcels of this, a little bit of canola, and a little bit of mustard seed, and then something else, and then there could be as many as three or four separations in a hold. Sometimes there was a separation across a corner because it was just a very small. Mm. But then they would supply a finished plan, showing where this stuff is so that anybody that was going to be unloading it could see it and make sure they didn't have a mix with something that was mm-hmm. under it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When a new ship came on stream then,
yeah.
How would you get to know about it?
About the size and that?
Well, about the size, the configuration.
Yeah, well, we would get... I've got books around here like this. Here's one here that show those. Any time a new one comes out, it's got all the dimensions and all the different ship sizes. Hmm. These are all... This just happens to be laying here, but we would have all that information. Sometimes we'd even be going to the christening, you know.
Did you go to some christenings?
Yeah, I went to the odd one. In fact, I went to... I think I went to two of them, and it was quite an interesting thing. And all the time I worked, I never actually went all the way down the seaway on a ship either, because it was always at a time when I was so busy that I couldn't get away. But I did go one year on the Algo Central ship. And we went down as far as Montreal, and the ship didn't have orders, so he was going to have to go to anchor. So we got a little tug and went ashore and went into Chateau Champlain or one of those places and spent the night and flew home again. Mm-hmm. But and that gave you a different perspective too, the other part of the operation, what going aboard the ship and going down the seaway. And wished I'd had the opportunity to take another one, but I never did. I had lots of chance to do it, but I just couldn't swing
couldn't
it.
Couldn't get the time off.
Right.
Yeah, so what relationship, if any then, or coordination did you have with the bug guys?
Well, yeah, we ordered, actually the ship, ocean ships had to be inspected because they weren't regular colors here. Nobody knew what the shape they were in. So the entomologists had to go down and check the holes to make sure. But that was ordered by the ocean agents. And on the ocean ships, we were the charterer's representative. And somebody like Bill Ribb mm-hmm. or Sandy Henderson or somebody like that, that would act on behalf of the ocean. We had the opportunity to take that over as well, but we decided no, we had our hands full. This was years and years before they started coming up here on a regular basis, before the seaway opened. Mm-hmm. And so we did do a few small ones that loaded some barley. And then they topped the holes off with some flour from Robin Hood. Yeah, the Homestead was the name of one of the ships that did that. But and we were the agent for that. Mm.
Yes, I noticed, again, in the employee records that I was looking at, that a couple of people had left to work for an organization that dealt with the ocean-going ships. But that wasn't the agents, was it, that they worked for? Or was it a separate group?
I don't know who you're referring to. The ocean agents were a different group altogether. Mm-hmm. We had nothing to do with their operation, except that if it was Bill Ribb, for example, if he had a ship that he was the agent for, an ocean ship, he would be the actual agent for the ship. He would still have to get his information from us as to when...
For the loading and all of that.
To when he could bring the ship in.
Okay.
Where to go and he would be the one that would be checking to see if the ship was going to work overtime, and he'd be talking to the owners or the shippers, whichever one would benefit by getting the ship out quicker. Mm-hmm. And whereas on the Lakers, I determined whether the ship was going to work. So the vessel owners had given me the authority to just go ahead and work whenever, pay whatever overtime you have to. Mm-hmm.
And still cheaper than
yeah.
than the time losing.
Well, yes, it's cheaper than having the ship sitting around doing nothing.
Now, with the inspectors then for the lake ships, they still had to, entomology, the Department of Agriculture, I guess, as opposed to the Canadian Grain Commission.
Yeah.
They still had to be involved. So when would you get them involved in the picture so that the schedule didn't get shot?
Yeah, no, the inspectors, there were inspectors in the elevator. There were inspectors as at the elevator when the ships were being loaded. And they would take samples.
Mm-hmm.
They used to take them right out on the deck, and I think they do it all in the elevator now.
Yeah.
But at one time, they used to take them all right on the deck, and they'd be walking up and down the deck and as the grain was being loaded, and just to make sure that the grain...
But the ones who did the inspections of the holds then, before they even loaded.
Well, the only time we had them do that was if the vessel was going to have the grain in it over the winter, and it was called winter storage. In other words, the ship would go somewhere, in Montreal or whatever, and the grain would stay aboard the vessel. So that had to be inspected. And, of course, any other time, too, if a ship was in at an elevator and there was a problem before they started loading, whoever took the hatch covers off might see a problem and report it to the captain, and he's right away on the phone. And then you would have to get somebody to go down, and they wouldn't load until... It was checked.
So they had their
phytosanitary certificate
or whatever.
Yeah, phytosanitary.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, these ships were hauling nothing but grain, and so they were regular callers back and forth all the time. So we had very little trouble with them.
Mm-hmm.
The only time was the odd saltwater ship, Greek vessels and stuff like that were a problem.
We had interviewed Victor Bell, who worked for agriculture and Canada, and he'd said that the old ships were really awful. They had all kinds of places for things to grow. But he said with the newer ships, with the nice, clean holds, with not all the cross pieces, they were pretty...
Oh, yeah. They had every little piece of angle iron, there was a little plant growing in it. I've seen that myself.
Now, the changes in, a lot of the changes in the company ownership occurred after you left, but there would have been some during your time. Did that
didn't really bother us at all, like Upper Lakes and Algoma Central combined. It didn't really have any, still the same ships and maybe a different name.
Mm-hmm. And, same with the elevators?
Same thing.
When an elevator was decommissioned,
would
you have an involvement there, or the elevator company just made sure to take all the product out?
Oh, yeah, they'd have to clear it out, all right. They would make sure that everything that we had a receipt for had to be accounted for, one way or another, whether it went back, onto a... into a car and back into another elevator or something. Everything had to be accounted for.
Mm. So it would be extra bookkeeping for you.
Oh, yeah, just a little bit.
It would be nothing compared to what you did on a regular basis.
No.
So I'm going to ask you a few rapid-fire questions here just because I would like to have them on record. And one that I like to ask is when you think back on your career, what would you like people to know most about the work that you did? Because that's what you're doing here, is you're telling people for historical purposes what you did. And what would you like the most to know, a sort of a synopsis, I guess, of all of the things you've talked about?
Well, I guess I'd like the people to know that we had a very important part to play in the overall picture, and we did it as well as we could. We helped feed the world, if you will, and we were fair with everybody, I think.
Interesting. When I talked to Mr. Kelso,
yeah,
that word fair was high on his list.
Yeah.
Of we tried to be fair.
And you know, everything was done on your word when I was working. If you said, you know, we ordered an elevator crew out and they were there. And if the elevator said they had a certain amount of grain and they'd have the rest ready for you in the morning, you took them at their word and you sent the ship in there. And I don't know how many times I sent the ship into an elevator, and I had my doubts, but not once did they not keep their word.
Mm-hmm. They didn't let you down.
Never, never. And everything, like I say, everything was done on your word. You know, you didn't have to sign a piece of paper or anything. You said something, and your word was your bond.
Mm-hmm. Did that change at all during the time of your career?
It was changing just as I decided to back it up when I got 60. A year or so before that, it started to get, for lack of a better word, a little cutthroat. You know, at one time, one elevator would go out of its way to help another and this sort of thing. But as those older people retired and younger fellows came in and with different ideas and everything, it got to be a different ball game, and it was kind of, you know, a lot of it was remained the same, but it was starting to go the way I didn't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm an outsider looking in, and you get a real sense when you talk to the various players that there was a change.
There was.
Yeah.
I noticed.
And as you said, it was the start when you left in 96.
Mm-hmm.
Think of what it's like now.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. What are you most proud of in the work that you did?
Well, for a guy with no education.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, I started working when I was 15 years old. I didn't even finish high school. So, I think I did go back and take courses. I took typing and I took bookkeeping, and I guess this all helped in the long run. Then I took accounting through York University, and, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to, you know, upgrade a little bit, and I think, you know, I enjoyed what I was doing immensely. And it was a lot of responsibility, and I think that the one thing I'm proud of is that everything went as well as it did. You know, that's
well,
when about
you think
it.
Of all of the things that could have gone wrong,
oh,
and
yes,
the cost of those things going wrong.
Yes.
Now, what did happen? I mean, you can't possibly run an operation that dealt with the kinds of numbers that you did over mm-hmm. so many years, and a mistake never been made. So what happens when mistakes were made?
Well, I guess everybody, if you think hard enough, I guess everybody makes mistakes, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I never made a mistake, because I'm not infallible, that's for sure.
But even the staff that you managed,
yeah,
would, you know, you've got a lot of people working there.
Right. Everybody was bonded, and we never once had to say we're glad we were bonded. So things went pretty well. Mind you, we put in an awful lot of time. Like 12, 13-hour days were common during the navigation season, and that navigation season seemed to be pretty long sometimes.
Getting longer. So if there was a mistake made in numbers or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, the counts were, it was just a matter of, well, you straighten them out.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and elevators made mistakes in reporting figures to us too, and that they found out, you know, that the figure wasn't correct. They'd phone us, and we would thank them for letting us know and take it from there. I can't think offhand of any real screw-ups.
You've talked about changes and challenges, and you may have answered this next question as a result of what you've said, but in your mind, what were the most important events that happened in the workplace during your career? The most important events?
Well, the most important event, as far as I'm concerned, and one of the things I'm proudest of, is 1983's loading, like I mentioned before, 17,700,000 tons in 885 ships. That's quite an accomplishment. And I think I don't know if that record will ever be beat by anybody. And it's because of the trimmers doing an excellent job and available all the time. The elevators going out of their way to work extra hours. The ships were in the bay waiting to load. Everything was just right. And but that's, we cleared, that was a weekend to never forget. That's the one thing that I'm really proudest of.
Good. Do you feel it's important to preserve and share Thunder Bay's grain trade history? And if so, what aspects of the history do you feel should we concentrate on preserving, especially as it relates to Lake Shippers?
Well, naturally, grain shipping out of the port was the big thing years ago, before lumber or, you know, whatever. But, and I think the more we can preserve, the better. Down the road, it's going to help an awful lot of people. And it's too bad that some of the younger people don't have classes where they can learn about this sort of stuff so that they know, you know, what their grandfathers and so on had to go through to, you know, make things good for the family and for the world, really. Like I said before, I think it's a shame that we're losing so much of this history, and it's a shame that we're losing the Lake Shippers, that we lost the Lake Shippers, and I'm just hoping that grain trimmers is not the next one to go. I'd hate to see that.
Big changes.
Yeah, big changes.
So when you think of the Lake Shippers then, we're, as a group, Friends of Grain Elevators, we came together with the hope of someday establishing a national historic activity center here, because we felt this was the grain trade that you talked about was a national story, not just a
Definitely.
Not just a local story.
Right.
And if we were to ever get a place to strut our stuff, to put it
right, yeah.
What about Lake Shippers? Would you like featured?
Well, I guess we can go right back to the early days and you know, explain how Lake Shippers was formed. I didn't even touch on that, but
well, maybe you should.
It was because of the length of time it was taking to load ships in the port, and everybody was dissatisfied with the way things were going, and because of that, shippers and the exporters and the vessel owners and brokers, they all got together, and bankers and lawyers and everything, all different types of people got involved, and they had this meeting which was held in Winnipeg, and out of that meeting, one of the bankers, I think it was, decided that why can't we form some sort of a company that operates along the banks, along the lines of a bank clearinghouse, and it could be done, and wouldn't that help the situation? And then it went on from there, and that's basically how it started.
So was it?
And that was in in 1909.
Was something, did they base it on something that was done in other ports, or this was sort of a Canadian solution?
See, we aren't a government, of course, like I said, we're a private, you know, non-profit organization. But no, we didn't, it wasn't based on anything other than that. And it seemed to work very well. Very well for a long, long time.
Must have been interesting to be in on those meetings that set it up, because they would look at the problems and they would...
Mm-hmm. How do we get around this? How do we do this? Now we're going to have to get the grain commission involved, and, you know, the inspection and the weighing and at the elevator end and so on. Yeah, it must have been quite an accomplishment. And I don't know how long it took to complete this whole... But I know they met in, the company was formed in September, about the 16th of September, I think it was, in 1909. So we had a 103-year run, so it went pretty well. It's too bad it's gone now, or it will be the end of this month. And I still don't know. I'm talking to Roy about what's going on, and he doesn't know, and I'm out of the loop now because I've been gone for 16 years, so I have no idea what's going to happen here. But I hope it's not something that's going to hurt the overall, you know,
the
movement.
Board.
Yeah. Now something's not going to hurt anybody, really. I'm hoping. But I'm apprehensive about this.
Yes, a lot of changes, not just in Lake Shippers, which is has gone the way of the Canadian Wheat Board, which also had a major impact on the port here. And the only thing that people can seem to agree upon is it will be interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. And people are just, some people are very, very bullish about it, and others are less so. And
There's pros and cons both ways. There's both pros and cons to it. I know that. I know that a lot of the farmers in, let's say, in Manitoba, for example, would love the opportunity to ship their durum across the border into North Dakota, because they can anything they grow they can ship there and it'll go where they know that. And but at the same time, the board had, when the board was formed, they were formed with the idea of helping all farmers. In other words, a farmer that happened to have grain ripen, or, you know, much quicker than somebody in another area, couldn't deliver it all to the elevator. He had to wait. He had a commitment, but he could only deliver a certain amount of that until everybody else had gotten their first quota. Fairness again, right? And that's what it was based on. And I thought it was working pretty good, but I'm not gonna get any farther into this.
Into that one. No. Normally, I don't ask any questions about that because for that reason. Do you have any memorabilia, including pictures, that? You would like to share with the project? We do have a scanner as part of our funding from the Patterson Foundation, so we could, with your permission.
You know, I got some. You might be interested in some of this stuff. Yeah.
Now, before I look at that, I do have to ask you another question.
Yeah.
My grandfather, who worked for Lake Shippers, he was hired on as a caretaker. I understand that job.
Yeah.
But he was also a messenger and caretaker. So what did a messenger do?
Okay. Messenger. Messenger. What did we did have a messenger at one time. Oh. What were they doing?
Would they be delivering stuff to the elevators?
No, because the elevators, even after, when I just first started, the companies were all sending people up to the office to pick up stuff. But I've heard that term messenger in connection with late shippers, but...
Just running around the office delivering things to different people? It's not that big office.
Well, it was a fair size. Yeah. It was the whole top of chapel.
Well, if you ever find out, let me know.
Yeah, I will.
Now, I think we'll sign off here.
Sure.
And maybe just discuss what you have. And I may want to go back on to discuss certain pictures.
Yeah, I have a lot of older pictures here and some recent ones.
Okay, well, let's sign off and then we'll see if you come back in.